Welcome to Counterspin, your weekly look behind the headlines of the mainstream news. I'm Janine Jackson, here with Steve Rendell. This week on Counterspin, the removal of Jewish settlers from their homes in Gaza is certainly a compelling human interest story. But reporting focusing only on the suffering and angst of settlers and other Israelis largely fails to include Palestinian views and the larger context in which the withdrawals are taking place. Simona Sharoni, University of Oregon professor and activist, will join us from Tel Aviv to talk about Gaza coverage. Also on the show, are frivolous lawsuits and jury awards to plaintiffs out of control? That's what some business lobbyists and conservative politicians would like you to believe. Our guest says that those groups get an assist, if not an intentional one, from misleading media coverage of the civil justice system. Myron Levin is a staff writer for the Los Angeles Times. All of that's coming up, but first, as usual, we'll take a look back at recent press.
The Washington Post on August 15th announced that it would withdraw its co-sponsorship of the Freedom Walk, a Pentagon event planned for September 11th to commemorate the attacks of 2001 and at the same time celebrate the troops in Iraq. The Post, which had gotten significant criticism for its embrace of the event, including from some of its own reporters, said in announcing its withdrawal that, quote, "it appears that this event could become politicized," close quote. We don't know how to break this to the Post, but if the Pentagon organizes a support the troops rally during wartime, that's already politicized, especially if it ties that rally to the commemoration of an atrocity that has been frequently used to whip up support for that war, even though in reality it had nothing to do with it. The Post might have also gotten a hint of the event's pro-war politics by listening to a song by Clint Black, who was chosen to headline the concert following the Freedom Walk. Called "I Rock and Roll," the song is a celebration of the invasion with a word for those who might protest it. Quote, "It might be a smart bomb. They find stupid people, too. And if you stand with the likes of Saddam, one just might find you," close quote. Well, it's a relief that the Washington Post won't be co-sponsoring an event where opponents of the Iraq War are threatened with being blown up. Sadly, fantasies of doing away with dissidents are becoming commonplace on the right. Take an August 11 broadcast by Rush Limbaugh, recorded by the group Media Matters, where Limbaugh asks listeners, quote, "Wouldn't it be great if anybody who speaks out against the country, to kick them out of the country? Anybody that threatens this country, kick them out. We'd get rid of Michael Moore. We'd get rid of half the Democratic Party if we would just import that law. That would be fabulous," close quote. Like Clint Black, Limbaugh seems to have forgotten that the war on terror was supposedly launched in defense of our freedoms.
On August 16th, the Boston Globe ran an op-ed column attacking the National Education Association for joining a back-to-school boycott campaign against Walmart. The column was written by Michael Reitz of the Evergreen Freedom Foundation, identified by the Globe as a nonpartisan public policy research organization. Reitz called the boycott little more than a union solidarity move, and he wrote with evident disdain that the NEA, quote, "even criticizes the Walton family, the founders of Walmart," close quote, for their contributions to groups that support voucher initiatives and other efforts that the NEA considers anti-public education. Reading that, Globe readers probably would have wanted to know that Reitz's employer is one of those very groups. The Evergreen Freedom Foundation has received hundreds of thousands of dollars from the Walton Family Foundation, a little conflict of interest that the Globe neglected to mention. The Globe ran a clarification the next day, noting the funding connection, but really, shouldn't that sort of cursory research be done before such a piece even runs?
In an August 16th guest op-ed in the New York Times, Zev Heifetz, regular columnist for the New York Daily News, recounted a speech Israeli Prime Minister Ariel Sharon recently gave in Paris. Recalling the powerful influences in his career, Sharon evidently noted that his mother topped the list with her admonition to him about Arabs. Quote, "never trust them," close quote. Heifetz points to this motherly advice as a key to understanding Sharon's policy positions, but he expresses no dismay about it, which isn't surprising given his own stated views. arguing for the Iraq invasion in a 2002 article for the New Haven Register, for example. Heifetz wrote, quote, "The Arab Middle East is, by Western standards to be sure, the world's most backward, xenophobic, and irrational region," close quote. Iraq, he argued, was just the beginning, since nothing short of domination can improve the, quote, "collective mental health of Arab societies," close quote. So Heifetz passing off Sharon's racism as real politic is one thing, but one has to wonder whether the Times would have permitted an Arab leader's public statements about the untrustworthiness of Jews to be treated in quite the same fashion.
Former FCC Chair Michael Powell's new job with the media industry company Providence Equity Partners has raised some eyebrows. The concern is that a former regulator would leave a government agency to go work for the industry he or she formerly regulated. The practice is eyebrow-raising. It's also ridiculously common. So common that, as the Center for Digital Democracy's Jeff Chester pointed out in an August 11th Alternet commentary, five former FCC chairs, Richard Wiley, Mark Fowler, Dennis Patrick, Reed Hunt, and William Kennard, have taken jobs working for the media industry they'd previously been tasked with watchdogging. So it's almost strange for people to be surprised. But Powell's move occasioned a prominent New York Times business story reporting that the former FCC chair had changed sides. Critics would argue that Powell has worked for the media industry all along. He hasn't changed sides, just income brackets.
And finally, while mainstream media reported prominently on the life and legacy of ABC's Peter Jennings, the death of African-American publisher John H. Johnson received less attention. That meant Americans missed an opportunity to reflect on the history of the black press and its influence on U.S. journalism. Johnson started Ebony magazine in 1945 when there were no magazines reflecting the full range of African-American life. And in 1951, he added the news magazine Jet. It was Jet that published the photograph of the body of lynching victim Emmett Till in 1955, an image that many say galvanized the U.S. civil rights movement. Over the years, Johnson and his magazines played a key role in the civil rights struggle.
Thank you, Steve. You are listening to Counterspin. Counterspin is brought to you each week by the Media Watch Group FAIR.
Media images of Israel's removal of Jewish settlers from occupied Gaza depict an emotionally wrenching scene in which settlers are being evicted by their former protectors, the Israeli Defense Forces. It's no doubt a compelling story, but what's missing from this narrow picture are Palestinian views and a larger context. For example, media coverage too rarely includes relevant information about the legality of those settlements or the history of the area, where Palestinians were ousted from their homes by the hundreds of thousands in the 1940s. Much of the press has not even been clear on the current situation. You might not know, for instance, that the military occupation of Gaza will continue in large part, as will new building in the Israeli-occupied West Bank. Joining us now to talk about Gaza coverage is Simona Scironi, the 2004-2005 Savage Professor of Peace Studies at the University of Oregon. She is also the author of, among other things, Gender and the Israeli-Palestinian Conflict, The Politics of Women's Resistance. She's also an Israeli Army veteran. She joins us now from Tel Aviv. Simona Scironi, welcome to Counterspin.
Thanks for having me.
Well, let's begin with your general thoughts about U.S. coverage of the Gaza withdrawal.
As you said in your preface, the focus has been on the human drama, but more specifically the human drama of the Jewish people, devoid of any historical and political context. There are keywords of brothers that have to expel one another, totally feeding off the slogan of the settlers that how can a Jew expel a Jew? It seems to be presented with the narrative of yet one more chapter in the never-ending saga of the Jewish people, with a focus on Jews as the victims and the kind of tragic, heart-wrenching move, the emphasis is on Israel making the concession, a complete skewed view of the balance of power in the region and the history of the Israeli-Palestinian conflict.
Well, the invisibility of Palestinians is a glaring fact in this coverage. For instance, Newsweek's major story on Gaza bears this headline over its online version. Quote, "In Israel settlements, end of a dream. True believers have passion on their side. other Israelis want a normal country, close quote. Likewise, a two sides piece in the Los Angeles Times on August 14th offers differing arguments regarding the withdrawal, but only from Israeli points of view. What would broader coverage include?
Well, ironically, the only reference to the occupation and to what it means to be a Palestinian in Gaza came in the speech of Prime Minister Ariel Sharon yesterday, who mentioned the dire straits and the inhumane living conditions of Palestinians in the refugee camp in Gaza as a reason to why he has to evacuate settlements, because no one could grow in such conditions and think of peace. I think one focuses on the human drama, which the American media does. There is a great human drama on the Palestinian side. It unfolds daily. It's been unfolding since 1948. And if one looks at Gaza, in every refugee camp, there's a daily struggle for survival, from getting food to being able to get a good night's sleep in heat and housing that hasn't really changed much since people were forced to leave their homes in Palestine in 1948. There's a human drama that unfolds daily at the checkpoints where Palestinian women deliver stillborn babies, where sick elderly people cannot reach hospitals. If the lens through which the Israeli-Palestinian conflict is covered is that of the human drama, then reporters and editors should look at the human drama that unfolds on both sides. And I would expect that they would set the coverage in context and point out that not only is this not a conflict between equals, the victim in this conflict at the present time are not the Jewish people and not the state of Israel.
Well, keeping the focus on Gaza for just a little bit longer, articles by the British Independent and Interpress Service, both articles ran on August 16th, say Gaza will remain the world's largest prison even after the withdrawal. And these articles point out that Israel will retain control of Gaza's borders, airspace, and much of its seaways. And yet many stories that we see here imply that the occupation is somehow ending with the removal of the settlers.
Absolutely. In fact, the Palestinians in the West Bank, Palestinian activists in the West Bank that I spoke with a few days ago, fear a southern Lebanon scenario where now, with the removal of Jewish settlers, the Israeli government and military have a free hand to bomb from the air and basically keep close to 2 million Palestinian population hostage and make the Palestinian Authority basically do the dirty policing work to guarantee the security of the state of Israel. So it is far from being the end of the Israeli occupation of Gaza. And the way it is framed as a concession on the part of Israel, Israel retains its right, and it states so, to re-enter the territories anytime it wishes. And now it would not have to restrain itself at all, because it wouldn't have to protect its citizens anymore.
Well, Simona Sharoni, with such a dramatic focus on Gaza, the much larger and growing settlements in the West Bank are out of the picture in much U.S. reporting. Is the Israeli press doing any better in providing that larger context to the story?
Very little. The narrative in Israel has been with a focus on the human drama. It's been fairly racist in a sense that despite the overwhelming support that the withdrawal from Gaza enjoys within the Israeli public opinion, according to some public opinion polls, over 75% of Israelis approve of the pullout from Gaza, the scenes that have framed the coverage are scenes of kids being removed and women weeping and people in synagogues, etc., with an attempt to create this sense of we're all in this together, and even if we don't agree with them politically, on the human level, we have to feel compassion for them. One, of course, should add that such compassion is not extended to Palestinians. As we speak, details are surfacing about the second murder in 2 weeks by a Jewish settler off for Palestinians, this time in the West Bank. This story is far from leading the news. And even though the murderer did connect his act to the pullout from Gaza and said that this was in an attempt to stop it, the compassion that Israeli Jews are feeling towards their fellow settlers stops at the border of their Jewish identity and is not extended to Israel's non-Jewish citizens. There's very little political analysis that talks about what will come next as far as the move towards an end to the occupation. In fact, the word occupation, as I said earlier, is missing from all coverage, with one or two exceptions of op-ed pieces in the Israeli Daily Haaretz that question whether this is really an act in the spirit of decolonization, and talks about the fact that if this is indeed the case, then the Israeli government should not allow the settlers to destroy their homes, because this wasn't the case when the British left Palestine or the Turks before them. So there is just very, very few references to the fact that this is a withdrawal from territories that were occupied in violation of international law and that have been held illegally by Israel since 1967.
We've been speaking with Simona Sharoni, the 2004 and 2005 Savage Professor of Peace Studies at the University of Oregon and author of Gender and the Israeli-Palestinian Conflict, The Politics of Women's Resistance. Simona Sharoni, thanks so much for joining us today on Counterspin.
Thank you.
U.S. legal system in crisis. Courts backed up with frivolous, even ridiculous lawsuits. Many Americans would suggest that while the terms may be alarming, the picture is more or less true. There has been an increase in baseless lawsuits, and it's driven by people's belief that they stand a good chance of a big payoff. In a recent pair of articles, our next guest suggests that certain patterns and practices in media coverage have played a critical role in shaping this public understanding or misunderstanding of the state of the civil justice system. Myron Levin is a staff writer at the Los Angeles Times. He joins us now by telephone from Los Angeles. Welcome to Counterspin, Myron Levin.
Thank you very much.
Well, so you found some mismatch then between what polls show the public seems to believe and the actual state of affairs in terms of lawsuits and damage awards. Is that right?
That's right. I mean, no one, I think, could really suggest that there aren't abuses or dubious verdicts, but at least it appears that some of the public perception that this goes on all the time is based on either made up stories or the conventions of journalism, which usually entail blowout coverage of major plaintiffs' victories over big companies, for example, and then more limited follow-up when trial courts reduce the awards or appeals courts throw them out altogether. The news often gets banished to the back pages if it's run at all. And therefore, people may have a perception that these sort of bankrupting verdicts happen all the time, because they dominate the legal news in the newspapers and on broadcast reports, and that they stand up.
People have sort of said, well, media maybe cover the award and don't do so much follow-up, but you actually looked into it and found real examples.
Yes. I mean, we looked at some major cases that have resulted in giant, even record-breaking plaintiff victories that were front-page news and even lead stories on major newspapers in recent years, such as the Exxon Valdez award, the big tobacco class action award in Florida 5 years ago, and then sort of trace through to see what the press, what these same news organizations or these same newspapers did when the awards were pared back or reversed. And it's quite dramatic. And really, we maybe added some currency to something that has been noted in the past by more academic studies, where they found that the press is much more interested, much more drawn to reporting on plaintiff victories, period. I mean, defense victories tend not to get into the newspaper or on the air. And plaintiff victories tend to, and you know, the bigger, the more likely they are to get there. And it's probably, in the short-term sense, a good news judgment, because when plaintiffs beat a big corporation in a case, I mean, it is news. It demonstrates that a jury was really angry about some evidence that it heard. It potentially moves a lot of money around and changes the status quo. So it's not a misjudgment maybe to focus on plaintiff victories, but it's inattention or a lack of attention span to not follow through and write about what really happens.
It's kind of a man bites dog. In other words, a big jury award is more interesting perhaps to journalists simply because it's big, but that doesn't mean that it's representative.
No, exactly right. And I mean, one of the examples that we had was that there was a major verdict against Ford Motor Company over an Explorer rollover that crippled a woman in San Diego a little over a year ago. And what we found was there was a lot of coverage of this mega verdict, as there should have been. But Ford had won a dozen or so very similar cases, and there was hardly any press coverage of that at all.
I would note that in your articles that ran on August, I guess, 14th and 15th in the Times and are available still on the Times website, it's not just your own research, but you cite some other research that tends to shore up the points that you're making, one about how auto liability cases, as I recall, were many times more likely to get media coverage when the plaintiffs won than when defendants won. So there is other research that tends to support your findings.
Right. Rand had done an analysis of auto liability cases during the 80s and 90s, and they looked at 351 trials that they learned of, and to try to see what was the propensity of the press to cover these cases. And they found that when plaintiffs won, the cases were far more likely to be covered than when defendants won.
All right, then. In one of your articles, you talk about legal urban legends. What do you mean by that?
Well, these are just kind of made-up things. And honestly, I had started out to write the first story that we've been talking about now as distortions that might be created in public perception, not based on any inaccuracy, but just based on the emphasis that the press gives certain events in the legal system. And I found as I went along, something I hadn't been aware of, other people had, that there are circulating on the internet and also even picked up by the mainstream press, some just flat made-up false stories designed to make the legal system look like it's lost its mind, people that behave in really stupid or irresponsible ways, file lawsuits and persuade juries to give them ungodly amounts of money. And so we wrote about how these myths have propagated, how humorous but also outrageous they are, and how they find their way into editorials and columns and newspapers and on broadcasts where pundits or others are trying to show examples of how gullible juries are or how the legal system has gone haywire. And, of course, the gullible people are the people in the press that didn't check out these stories to see if they were true, and indeed they weren't.
Well, and you make the point that it's not just cranky little websites, but major media that have fallen for some of these stories. We at FAIR had a little back and forth with Mort Zuckerman a while ago.
Oh, yes.
U.S. News ran one of those patently false anecdotes, and we got an interesting response, which was we were told that they didn't need to run a correction because, well, a lot of people believe these anecdotes to be true.
Well, actually, if you followed it on through, Janine, you would see that they ran a sort of a correction. They ran a statement saying that we published some reports that we had picked up from reputable publications or reputable media that we couldn't document. They didn't actually say they were false or who the reputable sources they had for these, but they used the one about, for instance, I think, correct me if I'm wrong, about the woman who threw the drink at the boyfriend in the restaurant, gets up in a huff, walks away, slips on the wet spot, breaks her coccyx, tailbone, sues and wins $113,500. I think that was one of the ones that appeared in Zuckerman's column in U.S. News.
And they say simply, well, we recount it. We heard them someplace else.
But completely made up.
Not
a great story, wonderful barroom conversation, but Not true.
Okay, then. Well, journalists can also influence the debate even with the terms that they may use almost unconsciously. And I found it notable that you in your August 14th piece, for example, refer to business lobbyists and conservative politicians, quote, drive to rein in lawsuits, a campaign that they call tort reform, but that trial lawyers and consumer groups say is an assault on the legal rights of ordinary people, close quote. Well, it sure would have been a lot simpler to just say tort reform, like a lot of reporters do, but I would guess that you think that leaves out some important information about that term.
Well, I mean, whatever one thinks of the various measures that are offered as tort reform, and probably many of us just as citizens, not as journalists, might agree with some of these things and think that they're good. There are many of them. I mean, tort reform or whatever you want to call it is a many splendored thing with some ideas that some people would think are kind of draconian and some ideas that people might think are good. But regardless, you know, anybody who wants to change anything, whether they're on the right, the left, or in the middle, calls it reform because reform is always good. Reform is always making things better. And the people that don't like what you're doing or are suspicious of it are immediately cast on the defensive of explaining why it is they don't want to make the world better. If you're a reformer and I'm against what you're doing, I am against making the world better. So naturally, people that want to change the legal system in various ways are going to call it reform. They honestly think it is. I mean, I don't think it's, you know, completely cynical. They believe, for whatever reasons they believe it, that these changes will be good for them and for society. But we stumbled all around about how to handle this because I didn't want to just say, you know, tort reform without explaining that, you know, some people don't think some of these reforms are real reforms.
That the term is, in fact, contested. And you
it's loaded.
We've just got a little time left. Myron Levin, any final thoughts?
I'll just say that there's been a lot of response to this, and it's polarized, just as you might imagine, because this whole issue stirs emotions, strong emotions. And so there were people that think that we were very much in the wrong for suggesting, this was their view, that there aren't any abuses in the legal system or there aren't any frivolous cases, which was not what we were trying to suggest, merely that some people have misinformation about what's going on or a misimpression. And then there were people on the other side that just thought this was long overdue and great for you. You know, you exposed some of these things. So, I mean, it's night and day, the kind of comments we're getting.
We've been speaking with Myron Levin. He's staff writer at the Los Angeles Times. Thanks very much for joining us today on Counterspin.
Well, thanks for inviting me.
And that's it for Counterspin for this week. Counterspin is produced by the staff and interns at the Media Watch Group FAIR, based in New York. If you missed part of this show or you'd like to hear previous shows, you can find them on FAIR's website. It's www.fair.org. The show is engineered by Alex Noyes at Mercer Media. With me is Steve Rendell. I'm Janine Jackson. Thanks for listening to Counterspin.